When I woke up this morning, it was already 80 degrees at 7 a.m. And my trusty weather app told me it felt like 90 because of the delightful, sticky, hairstyle-ruining New York City humidity. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Welcome to the dog days of summer. Well, okay, to be specific, the dog days actually refer to late July and early August, when the star Sirius appears to rise in the sky more or less with the sun. But it's become slang for this time of hot nastiness, and it is just so vile in this concrete slow cooker we live in on the East Coast that I am taking some poetic license. We have a show of summer stories for you this week, the general election economic plans of both presidential candidates, your attempts to balance work with, well, anything and everything else, and lobstermen telling their stories of work in a warming climate. As always, come share your thoughts with us. I will be reading them from the safety of air conditioning on marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're starting the show off with our segment Long and Short. That's when we make some bets on or against things in the news, but do it using the language of finance. This week, we have Marketplace's Rima Kreis and Slate's Words correspondent, Katie Waldman. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hey, Lizzie.
Rima, I would like you to go ahead and give us your long with the understanding that, it's heavy.
Yeah, this is not a light long. So mine is about racial wealth disparities. It's here and it's not going to go away anytime soon. And, you know, we often hear studies and reports coming out talking about the racial wealth gap. And this week we saw another one. It had a lot of sad statistics. Here's one of them. It said that if the status quo doesn't change, if, you know, current economic trends continue, it'll take more than two centuries for the average black household to accumulate the same amount of wealth as white families. So more than two centuries. Just crazy. And I should note the studies from the Institute for Policy Studies and the Corporation for Enterprise Development. And we actually brought on the study's authors on Marketplace's Morning Report this week with David Brancaccio. They noted a lot of interesting things. You know, one of the authors said how housing policies have really influenced this gap. We know federal policy in the 40s created home ownership as an opportunity for white Americans and set up a lot of barriers for people of color. But yeah, I mean, it's just this isn't going to go away. You know, lots of experts and folks have pointed to solutions, everything from like, you know, tax reform and fixing the structure of the way we finance our public school systems to creating saving accounts for children, you know, restructuring healthcare. But all of those require such big structural policy changes, and I think just a shift in the way that we think not only about wealth disparities, but I think racial wealth disparities.
You know, we talk a lot about income inequality and have over the past few years, but wealth inequality is a more pervasive thing. And what you're getting at is this issue of generational wealth accumulation or lack thereof, and how that can be a much larger factor than someone's income.
Yeah, exactly. Because it takes a look at, you know, income, whether or not you own a home, retirement, savings. And, you know, when certain communities have such a head start, I think it's obviously harder for other folks to catch up. This study in particular looked at the last three decades, and they found that the average wealth of white families grew by more than 80%, which is triple the gains black people saw and you know, more than what Latinos saw, too.
I want to shift ground significantly here, Katie, because, well, you are the Words correspondent, and I feel like your long for us is wordsy. Tell me about your long.
To make this much lighter, I would love to talk a little bit about Harry Potter and specifically the afterlife or second act of Harry Potter. You may be aware that July, the play Harry Potter and the Cursed Child came out in London. It is sold out until December 2017. So it's doing really well, and by all accounts, it's quite enchanting. And at the same time, the script is being published as a kind of eighth installment to the series of novels. And it's just kind of fascinating to look at the numbers that this script is earning in terms of sales. The script has sold almost 4 million copies. It's unstoppable, and to me it raises a bunch of questions, both economic about supply and demand, but also philosophical, like when do we accept that the past is over?
It's also wild to me just like how much of a spinoff there is. I mean, now I think even there's Major League Quidditch is a thing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy.
All right, so I want to stay in, I guess, what, pop cultures? Or this one, I don't know. Rima, is your short a flash in the pan? I mean, you're short this thing.
So, yeah, my short this week is about Burger King. They're doing some really innovative work to pull in more customers. So they're basically marrying their classic Whopper with a burrito to come up with what they call a Whopperito, which is very cleverly named. So for $2.99, you can get beef, tomatoes, onion, lettuce, pickles, whatever, and inside a flour tortilla. Instead of mayonnaise, it's all held together with awesome cheesy queso goodness.
So why are you short this thing?
No, I just really love queso. But I don't like the idea of a Whopperito. I'm not a fan of these mashup and hybrids. And I get it. You know, they're trying to appeal to different customers, maybe trying to get in some Chipotle skeptical customers from, you know, after there are outbreaks. They're trying to get into the Tex-Mex category. But I don't think it's going to work.
Katie, you're going to go out and get a Whopperito?
I think I will steer clear.
I just think hybrids should stay at state fairs. That's all I'm saying.
Fair. I do like a good fried pickle. Katie, give us your short.
My short is actually about what I think is just a marketing enigma faced by NBC right now, which is how do you package the historically dominant women's gymnastics team? Like, how do you deal with a totally drama-free path to the gold medal
for the U.S. team?
Yeah, I mean, there's no drama, and that's sort of the bread and butter of the NBC Olympics coverage is drama. And so I've been kind of intrigued by the way they at first tried to make much of the rule, saying that only two of the three individual gymnasts could go on to the finals on the American team. But I think right now they've just decided that everyone should just celebrate the dazzling athletic brilliance of these ladies, and they're not going to try to make an intra-team soap opera. They're just going to rejoice, which I think is probably the right decision.
So I think this is a really serious sport, and I think instead of creating all this drama and tension that may not exist, NBC should work more on, you know, informing viewers how the sport actually works so that they can be more invested in what they're doing and enjoy the sport more instead of, you know, creating something
sort of out of nothing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I myself would love a guide because I'm constantly befuddled by things.
Right. Exactly. Like, I think they're doing good stuff. It looks cool, but I don't know. Yeah.
Rima Kreis and Katie Waldman, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You heard about the racial wealth divide here in the U.S. In the U.K., there is a religious divide when it comes to getting work. Muslims there face more problems getting a job than people of any other religion. That's according to a new report from Parliament. And Muslim women, in particular, could be left behind. The BBC's Nomia Iqbal has more from Whitechapel in East London.
Cafes, clothes shops, a library, just some of the typical sorts of things you see on a UK high street. Walk to the end of Whitechapel Road and look up. You can see bright golden minarets. They belong to one of Europe's largest mosques, the East London Mosque. It's a major symbol of the large Muslim community that live here. Most are of Bangladeshi heritage. Many of the women are visibly religious, like Samia and her two friends who cover their heads. They've just graduated from university and are worried about getting jobs.
It's always in the back of our minds, and it's a barrier there. And it's also when you're dressed up and you're all covered up, that projects an image to them of what you look like, what your views are. So it's there. But I've never been discriminated against. But it's also when you're applying to big firms, you know that they don't go for people who look like you.
And it's that sort of stereotype of Muslim women that this report wants to tackle. It's found that Muslim people generally experience the highest levels of unemployment at 12.8% compared to other groups. Inequality, discrimination and Islamophobia, particularly towards women, are the factors.
A lot of it would help if you didn't have to disclose your name.
When you go in for an interview, I feel like that's when you kind of see their reaction as well, that they don't expect it. They have a certain image in their mind of what we're like or whatever, and they think that, okay, they won't fit in.
Discrimination over religion is actually illegal in the UK under the Equalities Act, so no employer could directly refuse to employ someone because they were Muslim. Ruby is a doctor at the hospital across the road.
So our hiring processes are a little bit more standardised, I would say, so I don't really feel that they're there is the opportunity, at the moment anyway, to be discriminated against. But I think as we get higher up, there's more interview-based things. I mean, I hope I wouldn't be discriminated against, but I think because of the current political climate, it's definitely something that you worry about.
While some women like Ruby want to work, other Muslim women I spoke to who didn't want to be recorded say that not working is a choice too. They say they are fine as mothers and housewives. Many also work in family-run businesses. There are many of them here. Jewellery stores and sari shops and nearly all the market stalls are owned by Bangladeshis. Alam came to the UK many years ago. He runs his own stall and prefers it.
Obviously, if you want to do a good job, you have to know English stuff, you know, obviously language. But some people, also people, they don't know how to speak English. This is the reason some people start work here.
Is one of your reasons for having your own business so that you could keep not away from any kind of situation where you felt uncomfortable?
Yeah. This is the reason, yeah. I can speak my own language, and that's feel very comfortable. I never feel like anything like racism, because I didn't work for like English company or anything like that, so that's why.
This report makes 19 recommendations, including improving career advice at universities and encouraging more employers to remove names from application forms to stop them from prejudging someone. Nazia is working for a charity here on the high street. She feels that her Muslim name can put employers off.
When they ask you what background are you from, I always prefer not to say, because sometimes I feel if I do say that I'm from an Asian background, it might be just overlooked or just put away.
What if you're asked your religion?
Well, I think that would make me feel uncomfortable because I don't actually disclose it. I am Muslim, but I don't actually disclose it because I think it might actually affect the outcome of me actually finding a job. I'm quite westernised. I mean, I wear trainers, I've got my tight trousers on, I mean, I've got my hair out and everything, makeup on. But I do feel like that. I'm actually hoping to open my own nursery next year.
So you want to be your own boss?
I want to. I think it'll be better for me. I mean, you know, certain issues that we've just discussed, I think it would be great for me to actually work for myself rather than working under someone else.
Many tell me that the current political climate is making life even harder, and the report acknowledges that. It says the government has to rebuild trust with Muslim people by focusing on integration and improving life opportunities rather than always talking about tackling extremism.
That's Nomia Iqbal from our partners at the BBC. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. This week, we heard from Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump about their economic proposals. Needless to say, there are some stark differences. We've got Marketplace's D.C. Bureau Chief, Andrea Seabrook, here to discuss the plans and what might happen to them if Clinton or Trump make it to the White House. So, Andrea, what have we got going on?
Donald Trump came out with his economic proposals. He would like to set new tax rates. Interestingly, those tax rates are right in line with the House Republicans, what they would like to do. He wants to simplify the tax code in general. He wants to get rid of the estate tax, lower corporate income tax. I mean, there's a lot of tax talk.
This is supply-side economics.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, he said a few other things. He wants to bring jobs back. In general, his idea, the big picture, according to him, is an economic renewal where American jobs and American steel and American concrete and so on become more important. The big line out of that speech, I think, that sort of describes his economic proposals is not globalism, Americanism. Yeah.
And what about Clinton?
Clinton's speech, you know, both of them, to be fair, took a lot of shots at each other. But Clinton's plan, it almost felt like a State of the Union in that there are like 100 little lines that could be built out into giant policies. So like, you know, she wants to raise taxes on the rich. She wants a new set of alternative minimum taxes. She also wants to close loopholes. She wants to a new tax on any company taking jobs outside of the country. And in fact, if they're going to do that, she wants them to pay back any incentives they got when they were in the country. You know, a lot of little things like that. She talked about investing in R&D, investing in seed money for clean energy companies and you know, the sort of economy of the future, while at the same time talking about, you know, jobs. They were both in Detroit, big jobs town, big union town, big, you know, manufacturing town, or it used to be. And so it was interesting to hear that.
I want to play clips from both of them that I think are perhaps indicative maybe of these plans and also where we are in this election cycle. Let's hit the Trump clip first.
Our party has chosen to make new history by selecting a nominee from the outside. And that's outside of the very, very already proven rigged system.
So you've been talking about insiders and outsiders. This kind of fits into your thesis about this campaign year and also this question of a rigged election. He has also said that the Bureau of Labor Statistics presents rigged data. It doesn't. And I think it's important maybe to talk a little bit about this, how this insider-outsider narrative plays in economics.
Yeah, there are a couple of really interesting ways to look at the whole idea that the system is rigged. On the one hand, it strikes such a raw nerve among Americans. Now, when Trump is talking about this, it's true that he isn't a political outsider. He's certainly not an economic outsider, though he may be a maverick.
Indeed.
And, you know, he knows how to play the system that I think most people worry is rigged against them. Now, the other way to look at it, too, is that he is setting up a potential sort of rhetorical out for himself should he not win the election. There's been a lot of talk about how that may just be the way that he saves face on election day.
Let's play the Clinton clip, because, boy, does it feel different.
I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
So Clinton's position on the TPP has changed. In 2013, she called it exciting and innovative. Do we think this is because of a shift in popular opinion or pressure from the left during the primaries? You tell me.
Oh, I think both. I think actually the constituency that wants the TPP to pass in this country is way more to do with international trade. Obviously, that's what it is. And copyright law and, a lot of big, important business interests than it appeals to, you know, regular voters. And so at a time when what she needs to do and what both candidates need to do is get real voters, the left and the right have managed to paint TPP as, you know, a big part of the problem, like the new NAFTA, the thing that's going to take even more jobs away. And so there's a good question about whether the TPP is ultimately scrapped or it will come back, where there will be some kind of rebranding campaign for TPP after we're out of election season, because the powers that are for the TPP are quite strong.
And we don't have much time left, but let's do a reality check here. Are any of these things going to be implemented no matter who wins?
Well, that's my favorite question of all, Izzy. Here's the thing. Congress has the power of the purse. Any changes in tax law must go through Congress. There are some things that a president can do with executive orders and moving around money within the executive branch. But when it comes to big spending, and especially taxes, you need Congress to approve that stuff. Now, the weird thing is that Donald Trump, in aligning his economic proposals with the Republican Congress, he may have a better chance at getting some of his policies put into place if he were to become president than Hillary Clinton would, because the Congress is still controlled by Republicans. And so it's a very odd situation where the more likely candidate to win is the less likely candidate to get those proposals passed. Either way, Congress not known for its quick, concise action in these years.
Andrea Seabrook, our Washington Bureau Chief, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Lizzie.
few weeks ago, we asked you one of those evergreen questions. How do you find work-life balance? Or do you? A lot of you called and wrote to us about it, so we want to pick up where we left off. Christina McElvey is 37 and lives in Portland, Oregon. A few years ago, she was working for an international shipping company, and her hours were crazy. She'd be up till 1 a.m. for a business call in Asia, and then she'd be back up at 5 a.m. to deal with a call in Europe. So she decided to do something about it.
I reached out to my manager and I said, listen, I am burning the candle at both ends. This is getting pretty stressful for me personally. So I talked to him and I said, I really need to cut back. And the way that I proposed doing it was anyone that had a title equal to his or higher, I'm going to answer their emails and then everything else can wait till the morning. I asked him for his support. He said, I understand. And he was great. He went through the rest of his department and said, if you need to cut back your hours once you're home, go ahead and do so. You know, we'll manage through it.
You've since moved on to a different job. I'm wondering if there are lessons you have taken with you from your old job to what you're doing now.
Absolutely. If I could go back, if I had spoken up earlier, I probably could have saved and given myself a lot more sleep during that first year. At the job I'm at now, when I interviewed, one of the questions that I asked was, what's the work-life balance? How flexible are you if I need to work from home? What are the hours that you're looking at? And, you know, one of the things that they gave everyone was a laptop and a work phone. And while some people curse the work phone, they said, use it at your own discretion. If you don't want to answer an email, you don't have to. What we're doing is not life-death. Everything can wait until the next day.
Did you start sleeping easier once you made this shift?
Oh my gosh, yes. There's a lot less anxiety, and I think it's really helped build trust between myself and my teammates because we all know that we'll get the work done. It's work. We need to not invade each other's personal space as much as we had before.
Well, Christina McElvey, thank you so much for talking with us.
No problem.
Then there were people who listened to our question and said they found it, frankly, a little tone deaf. That's what Sue Bielenberg thought. She's 51 and based in Los Angeles. She's been working a series of freelance jobs without benefits for years.
It just seems very anachronistic, like it's coming from people who maybe are still in a very privileged position that not everybody is in anymore. And maybe the person who would pose a question like that to someone in my position seems a little bit out of touch.
What questions should I be asking people about their work and personal lives and how they intersect? I'm curious from your standpoint, you know, when you saw that question on Facebook, what would you rather I ask?
How do you keep yourself sane with the pressures that you're under? I would probably like to see it phrased in terms of the assumption that everyone feels insecure. Even people who have full-time permanent jobs are afraid to go on vacations and afraid to take time off because they don't know if this is the last time they'll have those things. And they've seen examples of people like me, so they know it's possible to go down and to go down for the count. And I just feel like we're a nation on the edge of its seat waiting for the other shoe to drop in their life. And I think it would be good to ask the question, you know, how do you keep this this nervous tension from undermining your ability to function doing what you do?
We are in this, I think, post-recession economy that you've described so well, where so many people do not have full-time jobs with benefits. How do you think it's possible to carve out that kind of existence and not go crazy and manage to pay your bills at the same time?
Well, I'll be very honest with you. I don't really pay my bills on time. I've been very blessed that I've had the rent every month. And that's just, as far as I'm concerned, that's a miracle because I never go into any month knowing how I'm going to be earning during that period. But not going crazy, I think the biggest thing for me is I'm very stubborn and determined. I live in hope that a better day is coming, that there is something ahead for me, and that if I stay active and I keep my ears open and I keep building my skills and keep my connections open, at some point the stars will line up that I will have a job and I will have a paid vacation and I will have benefits. And at that point, I won't even care if I have an 80-hour work week. To me, that would be terrific just to have all of that stuff and would be well worth working an insane number of hours to hold on to.
When's the last time you took a vacation?
2001. I had a really nice in-house long-term job, and I did have some paid vacation time, so I went to the Cayman Islands to go scuba diving.
Let's say I call you back in a year. Where would you like to be then?
Oh, I would love to be at a full-time job with benefits. I would like to be working in my field. I would like to not be doing any of the gigging stuff that I'm doing now. I'd like to be living in the same place. I'd like for all of my car repairs to be up to date and not worry that this is the day something's going to fall apart on my way to clean somebody's house.
Sue Bielenberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for calling.
We decided to turn to Lauren Bacon for advice. She's a business coach who's been on the show before, and she writes about how to find things, whether they're vacation, work, whatever, that energize you. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been asking our listeners about this idea of work-life balance, but I know that you are not a huge fan of that term. You define it all a bit differently. So lay it out for me.
Yeah, I don't love the idea of work-life balance because I think what it gives us this visual of a like a teeter-totter or a scale where work is on one side and life is on the other. And the fact is that work can be very rewarding at times. It can also be very depleting at times. And the rest of our lives can be both, you know, can be either energizing or depleting, depending on what's going on in our personal lives. You know, the personal lives can be very demanding. So what's more helpful is to focus on where you're finding fun and purpose, because then, you know, things tend to kind of fall into a sort of equilibrium of their own, even when things feel demanding.
I want to ask you about some of the specifics we got from listeners. You know, we are in an economy, as one of our listeners reminded me, where a lot of people are cobbling together multiple freelance jobs, this sort of gig economy, don't have a paid vacation. How, if you are living that way, do you find a place to recharge your batteries? How do you do it?
Yeah, I think there are two aspects in there. One is the paid work that you're doing, is it kind of in your sweet spot in terms of, is it energizing work? So as much as possible, trying to take on work that helps you feel confident, that helps you feel like you're moving forward in your career as much as possible. I mean, I recognize that there are all kinds of variables in this. And we don't all have the liberty and the luxury of getting to pick and choose. And then wherever possible, to just put it out there and be as proactive as you can in trying to attract the kind of work that really does feel like more of your calling. And this can be in very small ways. You know, this can be one of many projects that you're trying to move forward. It could be dedicating 15 minutes to doing something that is just for you, or that just feels like it fulfills you creatively. Creatively on some level.
I'm going to take an example from my own life. What if you are the kind of person, and very much guilty as charged here, who goes absolutely all out, you know, maybe overkill on a project, a story, whatever it is, and then you have nothing left? How do you learn to calibrate?
Well, I think it's about paying attention to your patterns and paying attention to the activities that you perform that do recharge your batteries. So,
I should note that I love going all out.
Right. So maybe that's all you need to do is go all out and then do whatever it is that, you know, constitutes rest for you. But what I often task my clients with is literally tracking and journaling this kind of stuff. And it could just be like three lines at the end of the day. It's like, this is the thing I found most energizing. This is the thing that was the biggest drag. And this is the thing that felt like, hey, you know, I could really be into doing more of this.
In the work that you've done, do you think men and women approach this question of balance or satisfaction differently?
You know, I think that I don't think it's so much about them approaching balance differently as that their metrics may be different for what feels purposeful. I think, you know, women tend to find social relationships often or familial relationships more energizing and rewarding. But I think it's partly because we often get tasked with doing that work.
Expects women to step in and you know, do more childcare, et cetera.
Right. But I think a lot of it is about shaking ourselves loose of that cultural conditioning and asking ourselves, okay, but really, like if I was going to just be totally selfish and do only things that really lit me up and really charged my batteries, what would those things be? And, you know, some days that might be spending time with my kids and other days, maybe not so much, you know?
Lauren Bacon is a business coach and has a workbook called Essential Questions for Purposeful Projects. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
For next week's conversation, we want to know how money has changed your neighborhood. Has it flowed in, out? What effect has that had on you or your neighbors? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, and you can chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Just search for Marketplace Business News or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be used on the air. It's time now for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we bring in musicians, writers, and other well-known people to ask them questions about work and money, how they've shaped their lives or taught them important lessons. This week, we brought on a familiar voice from the public radio family.
Mr. Birbiglia, why don't you get up to the mic? This is Ira Glass, and I'm one of the producers of the new movie Don't Think Twice. It's a comedy, and it's in theaters everywhere. I also do a radio show.
And I'm Mike Birbiglia. I'm the writer, director, and actor in Don't Think Twice. And, you know, I get bossed around by Ira a lot.
Well, that's because you don't have a radio show.
That's true. Someday I hope to have a radio show.
Mike, here's the first question that we've been given to ask each other. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you blank.
Pizza, cocaine.
Oh, I see why your hesitation. You're about to say something dirty and you're stopping yourself, aren't you?
Hold on. Pizza, cocaine, real estate.
Okay. I accept that answer.
Ira, what was your first job?
It depends on how you count it. Like, probably the very first thing I did for money as a job was I did magic tricks at kids' parties all around suburban Baltimore and was paid up to, I think, $15 per show.
Wow.
And then the first job I had was I worked in a Baskin-Robbins. And we had a game that we would play, actually, that was a really fun game where Birbiglia, if you and I were like working behind the counter, the way the game would go is a bunch of people would enter the store during a rush, and I would choose any customer and point them out to you. And then your job in the game is that whatever that guy wanted to buy, you had to sell him pralines and cream.
Oh.
And then you just had to do everything, give him a taste, like talk it up. And it was really fun because most people, when they go into an ice cream store, they actually don't have a thing that they know they want to get. And just a nudge in any direction.
Well, you know, that's the dangerous thing about the specials when you're eating in a restaurant. I was a waiter for many years. Often the specials are food items they're trying to clear out of the kitchen.
What?
A lot of times they'll come up to you and they'll go, hey, the clam chowder is our special today. Really, they just want to not have any more clam chowder in the kitchen.
Because it's going to go bad.
Because it's going to go bad. Beware, marketplace consumers.
Hey, Mike. What's the hardest part of your job that nobody knows?
Dealing with you.
That is so mean.
In a nice way.
No, I feel like you've been doing this as a bit.
How fun it is.
I feel like you've been doing this as a bit for so long. Like, I feel like now it's starting to turn into the truth in your head.
No, but you have to remember, you're the closest thing that I have to having a boss.
I am no way.
You are.
Like your boss. What are you talking about?
I don't have anyone above me. I'm the director of the movie.
Well,
the only person above me is the producer.
But I'm not above you. I feel like I give you notes just like anybody else.
I know,
else.
But I defer to your notes much more than other people's because I think you are a Jedi of story.
But why would it be hard to deal with me if I'm giving you helpful notes?
Sometimes notes are hard to take in. Okay, Ira, what is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
I guess a toothbrush. You really need a toothbrush. If you don't brush your teeth, they're going to fall out, and then where are you going to be? A toilet would be a good thing to own, too.
Good point.
Well, you don't have to own it. The toilet, I guess, if it just comes with the apartment.
Yeah, but you also need the plumbing. You can't just own it.
Good note.
You can't just own the toilet in isolation. No, I tried doing that at Home Depot once. I brought it home, threw it in the living room. No dice.
Bobby Nasdor, when I was growing up, the kid across the street, was the little brother of my friend Mark. And a famous story in the family was that they went to a department store, you know, like being in a department store, they went to the hat company, and like all the display toilets and bathrooms. And he went. He pooed in the department store bathroom. No, he totally. And like, and look at it now. That was like decades ago,
right.
And I still remember it, and I'm mentioning it on Marketplace.
That is the greatest scatological anecdote of all time.
Oh my god. When did you realize comedy could be an actual career?
When I was working as a door person at the Washington, D.C. Improv when I was 20 years old. Because I was like, oh, you can do this and you get to see shows for free?
Oh, wait,
I'll
you
take
thought the,
it.
You thought the career was being the door guy?
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, I'll do this. This seems great. I'll make minimum wage and watch free comedy forever. But I mean, and honestly, that in some ways that was part of it, though. Because I would see like the Brian Regans and the Mitch Hedbergs and the Dave Chappelle's, who were the headliners. But then I would see that the opening acts would make $300 for a week or $400 for a week. And I was like, I could be as good as the opening acts. And so that I went on the road. I drove around the country in my mom's station wagon, and I was the opening act. And then eventually I became, you know, the headliner.
You remember the first time you were paid to perform?
At Fat Tuesdays in Virginia, they were having a comedy night. It was like every Tuesday night was a comedy night. And I was asked on short notice to be like the opening act. I think I was paid like $120. And I couldn't believe it. To have like $100 cash for just...
It seemed like a lot.
Yeah, and like I'd bombed. Like it wasn't even like I was good. It was just so much money, it seemed like.
Yeah.
It was very exciting. Ira, what have you recently bought that you completely regret buying?
I did buy a pair of pants from online that I've returned.
You regret it?
Well, it was an experiment buying pants online. Like, actually, like, up until literally a month ago, I wore exactly the same thing every single day. It was a uniform that I created for myself just to like not have to think about what I was going to wear. And it was just a pair of jeans and a white shirt or a blue shirt. And then a couple weeks ago, I was just like, I'm going to branch out and get other clothes. And it included buying a pair of pants online. And I sent it back.
Wow. And now that the listeners are tuned out, we'll continue.
With a boring story. All right. What's the next question? Hey, Mike, what's your best prized possession?
I don't have a prized possession because you can't hold on to a hug. It happens in a moment and it disappears.
the greeting card writes itself.
I don't buy into your consumerist constructs, Ira, nor marketplaces. I'm still hoping Bernie gets the nomination. It's not too late, America.
Ira Glass and Mike Birbiglia's new film, Don't Think Twice, is out now. Not too long ago, we ran a story about the process of refugee resettlement in the United States. That process dictates how a family winds up in one city or another. It's a huge task involving multiple agencies, extensive background checks, and a brutally long journey. Fatima, Ali, and their four children are a Syrian refugee family. They were assigned to a New Haven, Connecticut nonprofit. And our Tracy Samuelson has been following the family as they try to build a new life in a strange place.
Ali and Fatima have been in the U.S. about 6 weeks now. They're living in Connecticut, a state they'd never heard of back in Syria. And their family of five has just become a family of six. Fatima was pregnant when they arrived, so they now have four kids. The oldest is 4 years old, the baby just 3 days old.
Hi. Good to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Terry Schmidt, Don Quinn, and a couple other members of the community group helping to resettle the family arrive. Spreadsheets in hand. Okay.
So what we're going to do is try to talk about budget.
Mm-hmm. We all sit on donated couches around a glass coffee table. Ollie's four-year-old daughter takes my heels from the mat by the door and starts prancing across the floor in them.
Well, these are the months.
Yes.
Those are the months. Okay. This is what you're spending your money on.
The biggest item? Rent. Roughly $1,300 a month for a three-bedroom, two-bath, basement-level apartment in West Hartford, Connecticut. The next biggest item is food. For that, the group's budgeted about $1,000 a month.
The question is that what you're really spending? How much are you spending on food?
The other big question is income. Refugees each get $925 from the State Department when they arrive. They can sign up for cash welfare and food stamps, Medicaid. And in this case, the community group has fundraised about $7,000 to help pay rent and other expenses. But very quickly, the spreadsheet shows the family in the red. Right now, Ollie is in language classes during the day. In Syria, he was a teacher, and he'd like to teach again, but his English is very limited. He says it was better before the war, but for the last few years, it's like his memory's been frozen.
Does he feel comfortable telling me why he left Syria?
The group's translator steps in.
He said it's because of the war that was happening there. The house where he lived is now occupied by some militias that are pro the regime, so they are fighting with the Assad forces. And a lot of the property of his family were also either destroyed or also occupied. So he cannot live there anymore. So he witnessed, or at least he said, we knew that they killed other people. Come on.
Besides language, the other thing that complicates Ali's job search is this back injury that bothers him. He was riding a motorcycle when a plane dropped a bomb that sent him and his bike flying. Even so, he says he's game for painting work or tiling or laundry, all job leads generated by the group. But the timing, here's Terry again.
This is me. I would rather have Ali concentrate on language through August. So at the end of August, maybe be doing the interviews.
But another member of the group keeps asking Ali when he thinks he'll be ready for work. Ali mentions the injury, but then also says right away, this weekend even. He keeps telling the group he wants to work. And the refugee resettlement program in the U.S. is designed to push people into work as soon as possible.
Our emphasis is so strongly on getting refugees who are able to work into work immediately.
Kathleen Newland is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. She says that approach has lots of advantages.
In that the labor force is often a very effective engine of integration, but on the other hand, it means that people are not able to pursue recognition of their professional qualifications, if they have any, or to complete their education if they've been close to getting a degree.
Thank you. It was nice meeting you.
Thank you.
After an hour and a half long budget conversation, the community group leaves, except for Don Quinn. We sit for a while and just watch Ollie's daughter try and walk. And then Ollie asks the translator to tell Don he doesn't want the group to think he doesn't want to work, or that he's happy sitting around all day. And he's really nervous about being able to support his family.
Ali is really extremely worried that he might not be able to make enough money when he is on his own, when everything stops, so he can afford the living. The rent is very expensive here.
It is.
The group is supposed to phase out any rental and financial assistance around the six-month mark, if not earlier. But Don tries to assure Ali that doesn't mean they won't be there for him and his family.
There won't come a day where all of a sudden that we're gone.
She tells him, you can't get rid of me. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
we're going to end with a real summertime story for you from Rhode Island, specifically the docks at Newport Harbor. That's where a group of lobstermen spoke to Marketplace's Andy Euler about their jobs, their industry, and how both are transforming as the ocean gets warmer.
John Walker. Right now we're selling crabs. Selling these, weighing them and selling them. You know, it's a tough business. The real problem with the business is poor management.
135.
Well, it used to be on the fisherman's end. There were a lot of poor fishing practices in the past, a lot of overfishing, too many people out there. They used to think there's more fish in the ocean than have ever been taken out of it, and they'll never go away. I mean, everybody's not so closed-minded now. They know better. It is exhaustible, and it has its cycles, like things that come and go, and, you know, climate change and everything. There's definitely, you know, a little less of certain species around than there used to be. However, the way they're managing the species is counterproductive for us. How are you managing something if they tell you you can only keep 50 pounds of it, but your net comes up with 2,000 pounds, and you have to throw, you know, 1,950 pounds of dead stuff overboard? How are you helping to maintain a resource like that? I fish crab, I have a little bit of lobster allocation, and I work on fin fish, and I just started conch fishing. I've only been in business myself for 4 years. I came into it with little experience, so it's been tough for me to get started. Some of these guys, like that guy over there, he's been on boats since he was like 10 years old.
Paul Roussel. I've been doing it for 40 years. Yes, I've seen a huge change, and they send people out to do all this kind of research, and I hate to say it, but they're almost like ham and eggs because they're not really doing their job right, and then the government is basing rules on their research, and they're just absolutely not doing it right. I believe that people are going to be selling out, yes, and that has been happening. And I see a lot less lobsters. Hopefully they'll replenish. The stocks will replenish just through Mother Nature. I really hope that's what's going to happen, and it may happen very much because we don't see what's below the surface here. We don't really know what's going on below the surface.
Mother Nature always has its ups and downs, and it was all right until the government got involved with regulations that don't make sense. Right here, you can't see it, we're obviously on a radio. This hole in the lobster pot was made to let the babies out, the short lobsters, the small lobsters out. In 2004, the government raised that hole to 2 inches. 40 to 70% of the legal lobsters get away at any given time. Almost every business on this dock could hire another man and employ people if they didn't have that. Everybody's working on the edge of not making it. People are working alone. People are starving because of that hole. What business can survive? 40 to 70%.
Ralph Jackson.
From here, born and raised.
We were on our own for years. There's no OSHA here or nothing like that. So we were fairly independent. And now we're paying the price for it because they don't subsidize us, you know? That's just the way it is. So don't become a lobsterman.
Is there any way to make it more sustainable, do you feel like, from your end?
Patience. Things do come back. You've seen them rebuild rivers and, you know. So that's the same with this. They'll come back sooner or later. Hopefully, you know. Maybe not here in this bay like it was. They didn't come back in New York. They didn't come back in Boston. But they'll come back. Yeah. Maybe 10 years from now, lobster will be a great industry. Who knows? I'm going to get down there and tie these pots up.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, Molly Wood is in for me as we explore how money has changed your neighborhoods. Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or you can call us. We're at 1-800-648-5114, and yes, your voice might be used on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. And Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.